We're in the third section of the Rambam's famous chapter where he deals with the basic elements of Jewish philosophy, for those who are new. And this section is one in which he lists the 13 things that a person can do which can cost a person his share in the next world. That means that these are critical areas in the spiritual life, and breaking these things, or not having one of these 13 components in a person's spiritual makeup, let's say, these are major blood vessels, let's say, that supply the vital organs in the spiritual world. And if you don't have one of these, it's critical. Everything's critical in Torah, but as far as Torah goes, but in terms of a person being remaining with a spiritual being intact, these 13 things are essential. Of course, as we said before, it all goes in proportion to how much a person knows, how much you're responsible for, how you were brought up, and so forth and so on. But these are 13 things that are critical. We've mentioned before that he lists these elsewhere as 13 articles of faith, right? Which means that, again, not that you have to believe these things more than anything else. As we pointed out many times, all of Torah is an integral unit. If you miss one letter of Torah someplace, then you don't have Torah at all. We explained before, like electrical circuit, or any other entity that has to be complete. You can't miss 1% of an electrical circuit, it won't work. But these 13 are things that are directly connected to the lifeblood of the spiritual world. You'll see that most of them are universal, they're not necessarily Jewish. You'll see which are and which aren't. Now, the first area which we studied together was the 5 subsections of what is called, for want of a better word, atheism in English. The word doesn't fit exactly, but something like that. Somebody who denies that there's any higher connection or transcendent root to the world. And the next section, which we haven't seen together, is as follows. Shlosha hena nikroim apikorsin. There are 3 subcategories of people who are called an apikoros. Now, that word, again, I've no idea how you translate it. The first one he calls minim. The first 5 he calls minim. Minim means the literal translation means a species. I mean, that means a type. But that's a person who doesn't behave in a human fashion with regard to his spiritual root. These 3 he calls apikorsin. In English, the word, they call it Epicurean. It means, I don't know, somebody who's a pure hedonist, he lives only for the physical world, doesn't have any connection to the spiritual world. I don't know exactly if that's the right word in English. But his definition of it is as follows. Torah definition is as follows. If you're here for the first time, you're encouraged and invited to ask questions. That's what Sunday night is supposed to be for. If I'm able to, I'll try to answer. On the subject. There are 3 people, 3 categories of people who are called apikosin. First of all, somebody who says that there's no such thing as prophecy, that's an apikoros. That means if a person meaningfully and knowledgeably claims, right, and he means it, not somebody who brought up in this generation who just doesn't know any better, somebody who knows exactly what this means and denies it actively, that means he cuts it out of his neshama, so then he cuts off his route to the transcendent world. Right? That there's no... This person denies that there's such a thing as prophecy. Nevuah. Let's just hear the 3 and then we'll try and explain it. Ve'en sham mada, and there's no wisdom, shemagia me'abore l'alev b'nei adam. There is no such thing as wisdom that reaches from the core of the universe, that means from Hashem, into the heart of a human being. Which, by the way, is a fantastic definition of prophecy. You hear? Again, somebody who denies prophecy and says, what does he say? What does he mean there's no prophecy? That there's no wisdom. Mada means science, it means knowledge, it means wisdom, that reaches from Hashem, from the Creator, l'lev b'nei adam, to the heart of the human being. He doesn't say to the mind of the human being, he says to the heart of the human being. You should know that the word lev in Hebrew, which literally means the heart, when it's used in Torah, it usually means the mind. I mean, that's a loose translation, which is better than translating heart, is to translate it as mind. But it means the inner core. It means, and the reason he uses that word here is because, as we'll try and see, prophecy is not something that a person grasps with the intellect. It's grasped with a deeper root than that. It's something that wells up from a deeper source than the specific intellectual faculty. It filters in there also, but it it sort of energizes a person's neshama. We don't really know what all this means. I'm just repeating to you what the Rambam says elsewhere that prophecy is. We don't experience this today, so we don't really know what it is intimately. But there is such a thing that energizes or animates the whole being of a person called a prophet, and it starts in what's called the lev, which is the center of his being. And then it comes out in words, and it reaches his intellect, and it takes a certain pattern according to his personality. We'll try and see those things together. So element number one is somebody who says that this thing doesn't exist. That means there is Hashem in the world. He doesn't deny that. He doesn't have the problem that we had in the first section. He knows that there's a creator. He knows that he's one. He knows that he's in control of the world. He knows that he has no corporeal or physical element, as we said before. He has all those elements correct. But he just feels that he's divorced from us. That he like set the whole thing up and it sort of goes by itself. And he, or even if he involves himself in it, but he doesn't speak directly to human beings. That's the problem that this person has. You realize, of course, I'm sure as usual you're racing ahead of me, and you've already figured out that most of the applications of this idea, one of which, of course, is that Torah doesn't begin, which means that they don't have a code of how to live, even. That if you claim that there's no such thing as prophecy, if a person claims that, so then he has no access to what Hashem really wants of us. Because any place where that's recorded, he'll deny that that has any validity. So Torah, in all senses of Torah, in the sense of Torah Shebiksav, the written law, the five books of Chumash, or all 24 books of the written law, what they call the canon, that's all of prophets and writings, the person will say that those are human. You have many elements today who say that. So he doesn't have any access to knowing what the Creator wants of us, which means he's living without Torah, this person. So he's going to make many mistakes apart from just this element that's lacking in emunah. He's not going to know how to activate anything in his life correctly. And he's going to think that those are just human concoctions. That's the first thing that will happen as a consequence of this. But even before that happens, this person has cut himself off from connection to the next world. That's the first element. Secondly, let's hear the three of them and we'll try and explain it. Secondly, hamakhish nevuaso shel Moshe Rabbeinu, somebody who contradicts the prophecy of Moses. Again, that means an individual who might accept prophecy, doesn't have a problem with that. He might accept that there is the possibility of Hashem speaking to human beings. He might believe that. But he just claims that Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, who gave us the Torah, his prophecy is not valid, let's say. Okay? Now, we'll have to understand this carefully. Rambam doesn't only mean that this person rejects the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu. He also claims that the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu is not on a deeper level than any other prophecy. That it doesn't say here, but it's clear from when the Rambam writes the 13 principles, he emphasizes that point very strongly. And I'll try to explain that as well. But that's what we'll have to understand. Why does a person have to accept as an essential article of faith that there was a man called Moses and his prophecy was deeper, completely different than any other prophet? Why is that so important? He already accepts it as prophecy. He knows that Hashem speaks to him. He believes in Torah. Well, what more do you need? Why does he have to realize that Moshe Rabbeinu is technically on a different level? That's an article of faith that a person loses his share in the world to come for. You have to explain that. But you see, he writes clearly that that's a requirement. Makkish means he contradicts. Not that he denies it. He contradicts, in whichever way, the prophecy of Moses. And thirdly, a person who says that Hashem doesn't know what we're doing. That means he doesn't have a direct connection to us. And he doesn't see exactly, and by the way, it doesn't sound, not as ridiculous as it sounds. It may sound ridiculous that a person can know that Hashem is existing, which means he's an absolute, and yet he doesn't know, he's an absolute, but he doesn't know about me. He doesn't know what I'm doing. That might sound crazy. There is a philosophy, you hear many people talk about it, that Hashem deliberately withholds from himself the knowledge of what's going on. Right? I don't know which sounds more crazy, but there is such a philosophy that Hashem could know what we're doing, but he withholds from himself the knowledge. Why? Because he gives us free will. And if we, we'll get into this later in much more detail, the concept of free will, but if we have free will, and Hashem knows beforehand what we're going to do, then we don't have free will. Right? If you're going to make a decision about what you're going to do tomorrow, and Hashem knows beforehand what it is that you're going to do, so then you don't really have free will to do different. You might think you have free will, but actually the course was really charted beforehand because Hashem knew, and his knowledge is so powerful. It's a big argument about this in the Rishonim, we'll see it later. But if Hashem has foreknowledge of what you're going to do, you're not really free. So one way of dealing with that problem, there are many ways of dealing with it now, probably all true, as we'll see, but one way of dealing with it, which is not true, is to say that in order to let you have free will, Hashem just pretends that he doesn't know, or he withholds from himself the not. Of course, apart from the philosophical problems of an absolute not being absolute, apart from that, you have denied Hashem's, the concept of Hashem's all-knowing quality, the fact that he does know everything, past, present and future, that he's not even contained in time. So therefore, that's definitely not acceptable to say such a thing. He doesn't withhold from himself the knowledge. He does know what you're going to do, and you still have free choice. How that is a great mystery, and we'll have to try and understand later why we can't understand it. But that's the fact. Okay, says the Rambam. It's a mark of greatness to say you don't know. As you'll see if you ask me any questions. Rambam says like this, that those three things, kol echad mishlosha elu hein apikosim. Any three, any of these three, are called apikosim. Okay, let's try and understand a little bit about one or two elements of these three things. First of all, so what we have to understand is prophecy, the fact that it exists and what it means. Secondly, the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu was on a level of prophecy that's unlike any other prophecy in the world, what that means and why it's so important. And thirdly, the fact that Hashem knows everything that we do, not only what we do, knows what we think also. It says one of the greatest shames that a person will experience in the next world is the fact that what he did and thought will just be exposed. Right? Not only to Hashem, but to everybody else also. It means everybody you knew. Right? Your thoughts, everything that you did and thought will be exposed. It's a nice thing to think about when you are tempted to do something in private that you shouldn't do. If you remind yourself that one day this will actually, you know, imagine that there's a video camera picturing whatever it is that you're doing, and also it can see infrared in the dark also, to make any difference. And that's being recorded, and they play it back to you, and it's a very embarrassing experience. It's a That's part of the pain of the next world, yeah.
If you stitch up for all those things, do they come back?
No, you can erase the video by doing tshuva. If you do sincere tshuva, as we've discussed here over a few months, everything's amenable to tshuva. You get a chance to replay and erase. To do tshuva, just very briefly, you have to do the three elements as we've discussed before, one of which is confessing what it is that you did to Hashem, not to anybody else, in detail what it was. Two, expressing regret and the wish that you'd never done it. And three, the fact that you'll never do it again. If you do those three things successfully, you absolutely, completely erase that section of the tape. If you do it in a spiritual, in a way of spiritual positivity, not only do you erase the tape, you refilm the same events as mitzvahs. It says that those acts count to you, the same acts that you did that were even despicable. If you do tshuva from a spiritual point, there's two ways you can do tshuva. One is out of fear, because you don't like the possibility that you may be punished for this thing. You went to some shir on a Sunday night, and there you heard this idea that the possibility that there'll be a terrible punishment for things that you may have done. So you don't believe these things really, but you think that it's not worth exposing yourself to that risk. Now, if that's why you do tshuva, it's a very good reason for doing tshuva, it's definitely the place to start. If you do tshuva in such a way, what happens is you erase the tape completely with no trace. If you do tshuva out of love for Hashem, not out of fear that you'll be punished, but out of love for Hashem, that means because you really understand what it was you did wrong and what you've broken down in the cosmic structure and how much you've damaged your neshama and the hurt that you caused the people and so forth, other people in relationships, and out of that pain, right, and love and desire to correct the damage that you did, just like if you made a mistake in a relationship and now what you want to do is build the love again that you damaged. So if you do that, not only do you erase the tape, but all the actions that you did before that were negative are now re-recorded as intense mitzvahs. We've explained the reason for this before, and very briefly the reason is because it was those acts that brought you to this new level of greatness. You wouldn't have got to this level if it hadn't been for the understanding that you follow. Because you did those things wrong, and then you follow. It's like somebody, let's say you love somebody, let's say a marriage. And in a marriage, a person might, sometimes a person can be married to somebody for many years and never really get in touch with the actual relationship. They might never activate the love that could be expressed in that relationship. And it could be that many people express the regret when somebody, lo aleinu, dies after a certain time in a relationship. That happens, if it happens when the person's young or it happens when the person's old. Many times if you go to comfort people like that, they'll express to you the fact that if only they'd known that the time was so short, they would have done so much more in the relationship, and they often have regrets that they didn't just even express the love, more than they did. Men are especially subject to this because men are very bad at expressing their feelings. They take their wives for granted right from the first day of marriage, if you're lucky. And from then on, they don't really express it. That's why there's a law, Shana Rishona, that's the whole first year of marriage when a man has to dedicate himself to proving that his wife is the most important thing in his life, proving to himself and proving to her explicitly. Right? That's why you have a whole year where he's not allowed to do anything without a permission. He can't even, not allowed to go to work or nowhere. He's not allowed out the house without a permission. That's the first year of intense thing. Even if the country needs him for the army and it's a life and death thing, he stays home. The reason he stays home with his wife for the first year. Some ladies are smiling and some ladies are grinding their teeth wishing they'd brought their husbands to you. Okay. So next week we'll talk about ladies' obligations. But that's what he has to do. Because a man is not good usually at expressing the fact that his wife is the paramount element in his life, so it takes a year of devoting himself to that. Many recent authorities say that we're so bad at it now that it takes 10 years. The law of Shana Rishona takes 10, and there's some who say it never ends. So, that's what it is. Now, let's say, let me just finish this. So, if you're in such a relationship, and a person hasn't expressed the love in the relationship, so that's a tremendous regret later. Now, sometimes it happens that there's a stress or a crisis in the relationship, and it brings out the love. Because a person realizes, right, what they're about to lose or what they might have damaged. And sometimes, the greatest way of doing that is where the person themselves is guilty of having done something wrong in the relationship. But, you know, something that they really shouldn't have done. Sometimes that triggers an awareness of what it is and what they're about to lose. If that happens and then they use that, imagine if a person would then be shocked into reality and activate what he should have done and now build the relationship the way it should be. So actually the paradox is that he was brought to this realization of the depth of the meaning of the relationship through having made a mistake. Right? Now of course you realize immediately that there's no, you can't do that deliberately. You can't do that deliberately. You can't be unfaithful or do something negative in the relationship in order to later make up with more intensity. That's the Rambam will say later, that there are 24 things that block tshuva. One of them is if you do a deliberate sin, something deliberately negative, because you say you'll do tshuva afterwards. Or you'll wait till Yom Kippur and it'll be wiped out. Then you don't get a chance to get to Yom Kippur, you don't get a chance to do tshuva. We'll explain later how that is. You should rather sin honestly and say, look, I just can't stand it and I'm just going to give in. Rather do that. You shouldn't do that. But rather do that than say, it'll be okay because I'll do tshuva afterwards. If you really do that with that wicked, you know, deviance, then you won't be able to do tshuva later. So similarly, a man who says, well, I really want to show my wife how much I love her, so I'm just going to have this little, you follow, you know, problem right now for a couple of days, just a couple of days. I'm not going to enjoy it at all, of course, and then I'm going to use it. Of course, that is not a valid, you know, no woman would, you know, swallow that. As it is, we're very lucky that women do swallow most of the nonsense that men give them, and that's why they stick around with us. But that's how it goes. So, except for that exception, if a person would do something genuinely wrong as a mistake, and that would trigger. But if a person, obviously in a relationship, fixes up the relationship with his wife just out of fear, let's say a person, you follow, I mean, just the analogy of a husband and wife is, I'm not choosing it by accident. The Mefarshim and the Balei Musa and the mystics all use that example of our love with Hashem, because that's exactly how it is. It's not an accident at all. It's in marriage that you're supposed to learn about the spiritual world. Now, then the mystics say, until you're married, you can't do that. You can't learn anything spiritual until you're married. I'm repeating that again for a number of people here who've been putting off marriage. Now, you can't, you're not, until you're married, don't have an insight into this. Now, therefore, if a person would, let's say, do something wrong in a relationship with his wife, and then out of fear of damaging the relationship, he would correct it. But not because of love for her, but just because, let's say, he feels dependent on her and doesn't want to be alone. Such a person. You follow? Not out of love for his wife, he's just afraid to be alone. He needs her to look after him. So now he's afraid that he did something wrong. She's going to leave him, so he tries to fix up the relationship out of fear. That's not building love in the relationship. That may correct what was wrong. That may correct it. He might apologize correctly, and she might forgive him and might fix it up. But that does not bring you to a level of love. That analogy, if you think it through, is exactly what's going on here. If a person does something wrong and then he fixes it up with Hashem because he's afraid of the punishment, so he fixes it up and it cleans the slate. But it certainly doesn't become a merit for him. If a person, however, did something wrong and then he uses that to teach himself how important the whole thing is and then comes to a level of depth that he never had before, or she had before, then what happens is that what you did wrong now becomes a merit because it is the event that brings you to this level that you are now. So that those are the two levels of tshuva. And so in summary, it's like this, that if a person did wrong and the video is being played, so then there are two ways you can handle it. One is the safe way, which a person should do immediately, and even if it's only out of a doubt, even if you're not sure about the whole thing, but just in case there might be punishment, so you try and wipe it out, that's totally valid, and it completely cleans the slate. The person can get himself to a level where he really feels the damage, which takes a lot of work. It's not a simple thing. The Rambam says earlier, how you go about getting that degree of love. You can't tell yourself to love Hashem. Love is the kind of thing that's a response. It's not something that you don't do it deliberately. You can't set out to love somebody. Actually can, but you have to know how to do it. Similarly with Hashem, you don't just wake up and say, well, we're going to love Hashem today. It's an emotion. It's not something that it's not a logic. So to get to that is a tremendous amount of work that a person has to do. But if he does get to that level, then he could revise everything he did in the past, and it could become replayed positively. Just in conclusion of this point, there are some rare exceptions to this. There are some rare exceptions where a person can do one flash of an action and totally wipe out the past absolutely, completely, in toto. One is conversion, and a person converts to Judaism. Right? If a non-Jew converts to Judaism, so then they are completely reborn. We don't encourage conversion. We don't encourage conversion. We're not saying this as an advert. Conversion is supposed to be very difficult, and only for those who prepare to fight through everything, you know, there's no vested interest, and not for the sake of ulterior motives. But if a person does that, they are so born again, if you excuse the phrase, that according to Torah law, they can marry their own brother, father, etc. We don't allow it from a rabbinic point of view, but actually they're considered completely new in the world. Another time that happens, there are some other mystical occasions in life when that happens. Marriage, for example. Marriage, the day of marriage, is like a Yom Kippur. If you do it properly, the person goes through the day of his wedding, fasting, the way you should. You fast correctly, and you go through the chuppah experience the way you should. So it says that action can wipe out the whole past up to that point. And there's some other mystical things. A sundek, person is a sundek at a bris. If you behave correctly and understand what you're doing in certain ways, that could also work. There are certain other things that can wipe out the past. There are cases even of people who can wipe out the past also in much more drastic ways, but that's, you know, when a person, for example, loses his life, but he does it in a final act of giving his life to Hashem, right? Either, we mentioned examples before. The Gemara says there was a man called Elazar ben Dordia, his name was. He was a man who obviously had incredible potential. He had a depth of spiritual potential second to none. He must have been one of the greatest of his generation. But he had a problem with women. He had a problem. He had a problem with women, and he sought out every woman in the world, I think it says, who was of, let's say, indifferent morals. And he consorted with all these women. And then it says that finally he had a tremendous problem in this area. Usually we understand that a tremendous depth of problem shows tremendous greatness. It's tremendous voltage in that area, just misguided. But he must have had an incredible energy, spiritual power. There's a much deeper mystical level to this also, but just on the, first of all, on the simple chat level. And then it says he heard about a woman in a certain place, I think it was an island someplace or somewhere, for her reputation for being, I don't know much about these things, but some special reputation, put it that way. So he travelled across the world to find this woman, and then when he, let's say, became, let's say, involved with her, the Gemara says that a certain thing happened. I'm not about to tell you what it was. The Gemara, as I think when I told you before, I said the Gemara is not squeamish about the details. It tells exactly what happened. I'm just squeamish about the details. But the Gemara says exactly what happened. Okay, exactly what happened in detail, graphic, 100%. You've got to go look it up yourself. And I hope you can't read Aramaic. And over there it says what happened. When that happened, she said to him, during the relationship, she said to him, just like that thing, Bekitsa, she said to him that you finished, you had it. You've had it. You are non-existent spiritually. You can never recover yourself. You've gone so far now, you've lost your neshama completely. You've damaged yourself so intensely, there's no way back for you. That you couldn't even do tshuva. There's no way back. You've just gone so far. So it says when he heard that, he suddenly got such a depth of consciousness of what he'd done, he went and sat on a mountain, it says, sat on a mountaintop, put his head between his knees, and he cried until his neshama left him. He died. And the voice went out from Shemayim saying that he had gained the next world. I think it says Rebbe cried that there are some people who can gain the share in the world to come in an instant, but it means that he, and I think we explained before, what does it mean sitting on a mountain, who cares where he sat, it means a place of spiritual elevation. and putting his head between his knees. Who cares how he sat when he cried? The Maral explains that that's the position of a fetus. It means he managed to return himself back to the point of his... That's what it means. When the Gemara says that a person put his head between his knees, right, bent over like that, it means he goes again into the... It means he was able to go into a spiritual plane, return himself back to his point of purity, and give his neshama back to Hashem the way it had been given. So he cleansed himself completely, but he had to give up his life for that. It was so intense he had to give up his life to do that. And then there's also another case of the Gemara. This is much more questionable. You be very careful about this, but the Gemara says there are many examples of it. The Gemara says there was a Roman who killed himself. There was a Roman who was torturing one of the Tanoim. He was burning him to death, and he put a sponge on his heart, a wet sponge that he should burn slower. And then he suddenly realized what he was doing, it says, and he took away the sponges or the wet rags or whatever, so he should die quicker, and he threw himself into the flames. And there's another master where a Roman did such a thing, and he made sure that as he died, he fell on a stone that he should be circumcised at the same time. He actually gave his life, right, in an act that would actually enter the bris. It's an incredible thing. Everyone talks about these things. There's a case of Yosef ben Yoezer, if I'm not mistaken. Yosef ben Yoezer, Ish Trader, one of the first Tanoim from the early days of the Tanoim, just after the generation of the Second Temple, who had a nephew who had become an apostate, a real complete heretic. And I think it says that they were taking him out to kill him. Who was taking him out to kill him? It was a time after the Greek generation. Could already have been the Romans. I think it was already the Romans. The early days of the Roman era. They were taking him out to kill him, the Mephoshim say to crucify him. And as they were taking him out, I think he was bound on a horse, he rode past his nephew on another horse. So, his nephew was a terrible, completely left Yiddishkeit, and he denied, he'd become a real one of these people. So, the nephew said to him, how does the Gemara go? I think what happened was he first said to his nephew, if this is the way... that's what happened. Because the nephew was a very wealthy man. He had reached a tremendous position of honor through having given up his Yiddishkeit. Instead of being part of the downtrodden, he had gone over to the enemy. And because of that, he'd reached great honor. So he's riding along in great wealth and style. And when Yosef ben Yoezer saw him, he said, if that's how sinners are rewarded, right? If they come to such greatness in the world, imagine how tzaddikim are going to be rewarded. If a man who lives only negatively... He's going to be rewarded like this. He has such a wonderful life and such wealth and honor and so forth. Imagine how that's going to begin. So when his nephew heard him say that, so understand what's going on here, his nephew said to him, what about you? What about you? You say that if this is our sinners think, tzaddikim even more, look at you, you're about to be crucified. Not a bad question. So Yosef ben Yoezer, like a flash, he answered him. He said, if this is what happens to tzaddikim, if this is the torture that they put righteous people through, can you imagine what they're going to put sinners through? Kol Shekein. When he heard that, it says it entered him like a poison, or like a knife, it seared through his consciousness, this young man, and he went and he killed himself in four different ways at the same time. He set up a contraption that would kill himself in all four ways. There are four different death sentences that the Beis Din can impose. And because he felt that he was guilty of all the crimes that brought all of these on himself, he set up all four of them, a fire with a stone, with a noose, with a sword, all connected in such a way. He threw himself in, so he fell on the sword and he got burnt and the stone fell on him, the whole thing all at once. And he had all four things. And as that happened, it says that Yosef ben Yoezer happened to doze. And as he dozed, he woke up and he said that Bashar Kala Kidmani Zele Gan Eden. That by a short instant, this man has got to Gan Eden before me. That means the same place I'm going, he saw that this person had got there first. That means... That's what it is. Now, you're not a person not allowed to kill himself, so you're not allowed to do it. But you see that those are extreme forms of tshuva that can completely recreate the ball. Yeah, I'm sorry, there was a question.
If a person does tshuva, and doesn't always maintain the degree of self-control for a certain period of time, and upon the contact anymore, and he goes back to that same act, does that indicate that it's been wiped out, or does it
been
imposed upon
him? Did you all hear the question? At the back? The question was, yes, so the answer is this. The question was, if a person does tshuva correctly and then he makes the same mistake again later, what happens? So, very specifically, you asked a very specific question, and the specific answer is as follows: absolutely not. The original tshuva is totally valid. All he has to account for now is this new act that he's done. If he did it sincerely, He really did tshuva. And he wiped it. He said he really regretted it, wished he'd never done it, confessed exactly what he did, and said he would never do it again, meaning that he really meant, with all his being, if I could stop myself, I won't do it again. You follow? A person not predicting the future, when you do tshuva and you say, Hashem, I'll never do this again, you're not being a prophet and saying, I know I won't do it again. No one can know that. You never know what the temptations will be. What you mean is, I take on upon myself never to do it again, the way I'm holding now. If I fall next week and I fail, I fail. But if he did that correctly, he completely cleansed that issue to now. And next week, when he does the same thing wrong, he's got to account for that now. He's got to do tshuva again. And many people go through phases where they've got to do tshuva for the same thing over and over because they can't hold by it. But I'm just going to expand your question slightly. Sometimes a person is not being sincere when they do the tshuva. Sometimes they don't mean it. Sometimes what they're saying is, Hashem, I'm sorry, they're trying to cleanse their conscience, but actually, secretly, they know they're going to do this thing again. So then it could be that when he does it again, he reveals the fact that it wasn't a sincere tshuva before. And if that's true, first of all, it wasn't a tshuva and he hasn't eliminated those things. Secondly, he's got them still to account for and the new one. And thirdly, he's got an extra aver of lying to Hashem. The Rambam says that if you do a false tshuva, knowingly telling Hashem that you're sorry and so on, you get a false, you get an extra aver of things. But again, a person must be careful, they have to know yourself. If you really mean it, and you're really trying, and you really mean you were trying your best not to do it again, then that's what you must do. And if you know if you fail, and sometimes you know that it's likely you might have done it 25 times before, and each time you felt very strong, and you failed the next time the same opportunity arose. So then a person has to keep doing it. You have to be very careful, of course. The Rambam says clearly that after you do tshuva, you never go near the place again. You keep away from that woman, let's say if it was a woman, as the example he gives. You don't put yourself back into a situation. You keep extremely far to show that you really, right? And you keep doing tshuva for it. Even though you never fall into the error again, you keep doing tshuva every Yom Kippur. You never regard it as totally wiped out, even though it is. You keep it. And so if you've taken all those precautions, the best of your ability, and happens again. That's clear. Yeah. Sorry, I left that one thing for those who knew. That's very important. All this discussion tonight that we've had up to now is only sins that are between you and Hashem. Sins between a person and Hashem, right, like breaking Shabbos, eating treif, those things. Sins that involve another human being, right, that hurt somebody else or harmed them in any way, has got another whole requirement of just putting it in for completeness. You can't do this tshuva until you've done two other things. And that is, one, repair the damage that you did to that person. If you owe them something unrightfully, you have property of theirs, money, whatever. So then you can't do this whole thing with Hashem until you give them back the money. And secondly, you need their forgiveness for what you did. I'm not going to go into the details now, unless there are people who really didn't hear it before. Ask me at the end, we'll go into it. But that's what you have to do. Sometimes it's very difficult to know how to undo the damage. You might have hurt them personality-wise. You might have caused them to be miserable or depressed. You might have given a bad name to that person by talking badly about them. Lashon hara. You have to know how to correct all those things. The rule is everything's amenable to tshuva, but you have to know how and do your best. And then you need their forgiveness. And sometimes you need their forgiveness without telling them what you did, because it's not good to tell them. You need them to forgive you without knowing what it is. You've got to know how to do that also. But I'm not going to get into that whole discussion again unless there's some people who specifically need it. That's what we did when we started this section. So those are the requirements that you have. The easiest mitzvah to remember, there's three elements to it, and if it involves another human, there are two. Confessing what you did exactly in detail to Hashem with no one else listening, saying you're sorry for it and meaning you really wish you'd never done it, and taking on never to do it again. Past, present, and future. Present is confession, past is regret for the past, and future, resolve never to do it again. The other two elements, or if it's another human being, first to repay the damage, you have to discuss how that works and how you do it, and secondly, to get their forgiveness. But either three or five, and even if the person's not alive, it can be done. But it can all be done, but you have to know how. I'm sorry, yeah.
No. What happens if you do our virus, you don't feel good about doing them, obviously, with the intention of doing tshuva later, say, because you're not on a, or say when you reach a higher level?
Yeah, that's a good question. So let's try and make this distinction. Did you hear the question, Sivek? No. The question was, despite the fact that we said if you do an avera, a sin, in order to do tshuva later and wipe it out, that's invalid, but what about a person who's forced into that situation, like a person who's developing Yiddishkeit, and right now they're doing things wrong, that's what you meant. They're doing things wrong, they're breaking Shabbos, they're not yet holding by the madrag of keeping Shabbos. Or they're things they're doing wrong, they know they shouldn't say Lashon Hara, but it's very difficult to avoid, whatever it is. But they do intend to grow to the level where they will not do those things any longer, and they know that it's a natural process and it does take time. You can't leap into all these things. And right now, they are regretting these things that they've done, but they're still involved in those things. It's a very difficult question, and it's the kind of question that The Torah world is actually split about how it should be answered, okay? Let me try and illustrate this to you. First of all, before we get complicated, let's just give you the following basic idea. It's like this. The only question in such a thing is, it's a natural process, it's a natural pathway. If a person is doing things wrong right now, because they were brought up that way and they just haven't reached that level yet, they just really can't adjust to doing any different right now, but they're sincerely trying to get better, so you don't have to worry about it. Now, I don't know whose tape recorder this is. You don't have to worry about it, you have to do your best, but you have to be realistic, okay? If you jump in and try and do everything today and you become paranoid and obsessed about it all, and you'll drop it all tomorrow, you're not going to achieve anything. It takes tremendous greatness to leap in one day and do everything, even though you don't understand the whole system, and it's unbalanced. South Africans usually don't do that. There is, in Jerusalem, we come across people from all different countries. Americans do tend to move faster in this area. Perhaps it's because they've got a background where cults and sects and things are more kind of part of it. I don't know, but very often Americans are able to move faster. The English move much slower than South Africans, Australians somewhere in between. In general, South Africans usually take it bit by bit, quite slowly, developing over months and years usually. You get some fanatics also, but generally that's how it goes. It's a realistic pathway that a person is working on himself, growing slowly, and it's sensible, and it will stick with a person if he does it slowly and meaningfully. What do you do about the things you're doing wrong? The only question really, what can you do? What can you do? You go as fast as you can, taking on things meaningfully, right? Growing in Yiddishkeit, finding out to the best of your ability. The only question you have is, should you do tshuva? That's the real question. Should you do tshuva right now for the things that you're doing wrong? You're still doing them wrong. So no one has spoken about that or written about it that I know of, but in my humble opinion, it's not sincere. What do you mean? You tell Hashem, you follow, you're doing tshuva for it. Tshuva means, by definition, it has a definition. It means, I'm very sorry I did it, okay, and I'll never do it again. You have to say that meaningfully. Now, you can't say that. First of all, you aren't sorry. You're still doing it and enjoying it. And secondly, you don't mean you'll never do it again. You are doing it. You can't lie that way. Therefore, I don't think, I personally, my humble opinion, you can speak honestly to Hashem about it in davening. You can say, Hashem, listen, I'm in trouble over here. You follow, I've been brought up with these tastes and appetites and habits and so on. I'm busy doing this and that and other. Okay? My shop's open on Shabbos or I overcharge or whatever it is. Whatever it is. And, I'm trying, it's a heavy thing to get out of. I really want you to help me make it possible for me. I want you to help me out of the situation. I can't claim that I'm really regretful about the thing now. I don't understand enough to be regretful about it now. But I know that where I'm going is to a more sensitive level. So you speak honestly, you're diving for help. But to do true about something you're still engaged in, I don't think you follow. I think that you follow. Yeah, unless you're very sensitive and you can separate the details and do tshuva for the things, the details that you've left behind. So, but that's...
It's also the intention of doing tshuva in the future when you get to there.
No, that's a nice intention. When you get there, you'll do it. But you can't do the tshuva now. You follow. You tell Hashem, listen, Hashem. But one thing you should not do, excuse me, just hold on a second. One thing you must definitely not do is say, well, Hashem, I'm doing this now, and the reason I'm allowing myself to do it is because when I develop further, I'll do the tshuva and I'll wipe this out. That you mustn't say. Definitely don't do that. Just say, Hashem, listen, I'm in trouble right now. I'm caught in the grip of this problem, right? Or the way I see the world. The Rambam says that people who do things like that, he says clearly that a person who does things wrong, even knowing they're wrong, but because his whole world view and outlook is like that, the Rambam takes a very soft attitude to such a person. Of course, he assumes that the person's growing as fast as he can, doing everything he can. No one's saying it's acceptable. But he says you shouldn't reject such an individual because and even if you tell him he's doing wrong and he doesn't listen to you immediately, there's no reason to reject him out of hand because a person can't change his whole mental mechanism overnight. You follow? And there are others, though, who say not exactly like that. And that brings me, I just want to explain this point. Just hold on, please, for a minute, if you don't mind. And that brings me to the following point. The Torah world, in a tacit sort of a way, if you speak to people, you'll see, has been split on how to handle this question explicitly. What I mean is this. Let's say I've been in Yerushalayim for a number of years. You sit there with people who will come in, okay, and they're grappling seriously with developing Yiddishkeit and learning and stuff. But what happens here in Johannesburg, person who tries his best over here and comes to a lot of shiurim and tries to get the maximum input here can take a year or 2 years here to develop the way a person can develop in 3 weeks or 6 weeks in a place like Osamach in Jerusalem. Sorry to have to tell you that. There's a very critical, introspective environment where there's a lot of intensity and a lot of great people around, and you see people who are doing that, and the whole material world is stripped away. So you develop much more, you have a much more solid look at yourself, and you're cushioned in the whole, you follow, you sink into the cotton wool of the whole material world, and you come occasionally to a shiur to be entertained and to hear a bit. I'm not saying you shouldn't, it's very nice. But, you follow, it's like it's two different worlds. There people are grappling, shaking and sweating, grappling with the issues, okay? And there the problem is, what do you tell a person when he asks you, what must I do about this or that or the other thing? Do I have to stop it now? Or can I sort of gradually try and ease my way out of it? What do you say to a person? You follow, it puts you in a very difficult situation. Are you going to say to him, stop it right now, which is a technical obligation, you have to say that, knowing that you're going to destroy him that way. You're not going to be able to do that. How's he going to handle that? He's going to leave. He's going to break down, maybe. On the other hand, to tell a person, no, carry on doing what you're doing wrong, you can't say that to him. You follow, it's a tremendous problem. So the Torah world, Torah teachers who work with new people in those kind of yeshivas have sort of taken two different lines. One is a tremendous reticence to tell a person that it's okay. Rather tell him that it's wrong and leave it up to him to handle how he can and give him support and so forth and so on. And the other line is to tell a person to be realistic and take it slowly. And it's a very hard thing to say that, and I'm not qualified to tell you what's right, okay? But I've seen agonizing situations. I remember a case where I know a person who's today is a real London. Chashev, a young man learning in Kollel today, inshallah. I remember when I won't tell you details because some of you might know who he is, but I remember when he arrived at Or Sameach from a very physical type of background. He was very much in the physical world in every way. And he arrived, and I remember once, after he'd been there about a week, so he was supposed to be there. He had come for a few weeks. One Friday he disappeared. And it turned out his friends in the yeshiva managed to trace him. He was at some relatives of his, had a flat overlooking the yacht marina in Tel Aviv. And he'd met some it's an accommodating young lady from the Israeli army who had nothing to do that weekend.
Yes.
And they were, taking in the sights of Tel Aviv from the apartment. They, anyway, he'd fallen, let's put it this way, he'd slipped back into, fallen back into his former ways. So they phoned him, you see, the friends, and they tried to tell him what he was doing and this, and she'd be back here and so on, but it wasn't having much effect. And then, as a last desperate effort, they called a certain bochur in the yeshiva who was known to be a very fiery, very amazing individual, a really, really sharp, very, very amazing character. So they asked him to hold on. They didn't say who they were calling because he was very afraid of this person. And when this person came to the phone, he said to him, hello, have you ever heard of Gehenna? Anyway, the point is, he ended up in yeshiva. But a week or two later, he told me he had a question to ask me. He wanted to meet me, he wanted to ask me a question. So I said, okay. So we sat down in the base midrash and I waited for him. He walked in, he was white. Okay, he was white. He sat down, his knuckles, he gripped the table, the whole table was shaking. And he said to me, just tell me, do I have to give up women now, or can I do it slowly? I told him to go and shoot him. I told him. Big enough to deal with it. Okay. Anyway, today is a very amazing person. Very, very amazing person, what he's developed to in Tyre. So, to answer that specific question is very hard. What a person should do in terms of genuinely developing as best as he can is to make a serious attempt. That the general advice that a person should give somebody is to make a meaningful, steady development and not go overboard taking on out of proportion type of things. I remember, I don't mind telling you honestly, that when I decided, my own self personally, I didn't grow up religious at all, I grew up normal. When I decided to get in, to start keeping what it was, I went to my local, the rabbi of my shul at the time, a very special person, and I said to him, I told him what I wanted to do, and the only comment he made was, take it slowly and don't overdo it. And I was so amazed by those words that it gave me impetus to develop more than I was going to otherwise. He's a very wise man, he obviously knew exactly what it was, so what can I say? That was the right thing to say to me at that time, What impressed me was that I expected exactly the opposite. I thought that I was going to get clutches into me, but he didn't do that, So I think the general advice to give people who are trying to develop, honestly, is that it should be meaningful and gradual, but definite, and you should never fool yourself. You should go as fast as you can, but in a meaningful way. That's my humble opinion. The final thing I want to say is this. You should get advice from somebody who knows the whole halakhic issue as to how to do it. Before you decide what you're going to do next, you must go and sit down with somebody who's capable. I would suggest, if you live in this community, speak to somebody like Rav Auerbach, who's qualified from a halakhic perspective, because most people who make the decisions make the wrong ones. They pick on things that are actually not the most important things. For example, the classic mistake is they take on, let's say, kashrus, to start eating kosher in an extreme way. And they start doing extreme things, whereas they're hurting their parents, right, in an extreme way, which is the Issa Doraisa. That's a much more important mitzvah than many of the things they may be eating. So that's a crazy thing to do, right? And most of the things they're doing in kashrus aren't necessary at all. If you know how to handle yourself, you can eat in a place that's completely unkosher and manage, if you know what you're doing. If you eat cold food, you know, you follow, then the plates aren't a problem, and the milk isn't a problem. And so if you know what to do and you do it carefully, the trouble is most people don't know what to do. So they get tangled up and they make a wreck and they blow the whole family apart. And that's a much, you know, that's a step backwards. Therefore, a person should definitely sit down with somebody who's been through it or understand the whole thing and ask him, you know, what's the first move? How do I go about it? And make a, you know, plan or steady development which is healthy. If you've taken on a certain level of things to do, and you've done them, and you've committed yourself to them, and now you backslide. Okay, it's a year later, and like this isn't for you, some old problem shows up. You know, culpable, in that sense, is only a private question that you can know. The Rambam says that it depends on the person's inner mechanism. If the person genuinely just lacks and just couldn't be bothered, and he's falling back, and he's falling out, so then he's guilty for that, just like a person who drops his friend. Let's say he takes on a friendship, and he behaves with loyalty, and he treats the friend correctly, and then at a certain point, he just like loses interest, and he drops the friend and hurts him. There's no excuse for that. You can't just say, well, you know, like, you know, you got tired of it. You can't do that. It's a responsibility. Follow me. A marriage. You take on a marriage, you commit yourself, you've got to carry on with it. You follow. You can't, generally speaking, you can't, are exceptions, but in the commitment of a relationship, you can't just, so when you take a relationship on with Hashem, you can't just go a year later and say, well, look, Hashem, like, I'm not interested in this, and just drop it. You can't do that. But if it happens, because you really didn't have the structure, as the Rambam says, your whole philosophical outlook, the way you were brought up to understand things, you really didn't make a meaningful connection with it in the first place. You took it on as an attempt kind of thing, but actually, you follow me. Then you're not that responsible, you must just do the best you can. Only Hashem and you, maybe, or the person, can really work out, you know, which end of that spectrum it's on. You follow me? No one is ever held accountable for more than the best he can do sincerely. You follow? Now, so, but only Hashem really knows if you really, you know, how you're holding it. So what can I say? Yeah, there was another question? Okay, that's the general background to your question, okay? Now, next few more minutes, let's try and understand this. So, we said like this, that Nevuah, prophecy, is the concept of a wisdom from the spiritual world reaching the heart of a human, okay? There's some facts that you need to know about Nevuah before we can understand this meaningfully. Fact number one is that it doesn't exist anymore. Okay, prophecy does not exist anymore. Okay, there's a very sharp distinction that we have with the non-Jewish world. The non-Jewish world claims, the major Western religions anyway, and most of the Eastern bloc also, although they're much closer to the spiritual ideas the way we see them, since we know that they're based on Kabbalistic wisdom. But nevertheless, when it comes to the issue of prophecy, there are certain problems. We have an axiom that we're not here to criticize other people's faiths and so forth. We're just here to say Jewish facts, okay? The concept is like this. The Gemara is quite clear that since the days of the last prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, who lived at the time of the Second Temple, right, over 2,000 years ago, until that time, over 2,000 years ago, at that time, the last prophet was Malachi. We have a recorded statement of his prophecy. After that, there was no prophecy. There were flickers of it, such as in the Megillus Esther, and it could be Ezra and Nehemiah, but after that was all the same generation, basically. After that, we don't anymore have prophecy. By the time Hanukkah came along, Shimon and Tzadik, and when the Greeks desecrated the temple, there was no more prophecy in that generation. And the Gemara says very, very clearly that from Ezra on, from that time on, there's never been prophecy at all. It's been closed off. Not only isn't there, but the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah sealed prophecy and they closed it as a deliberate act. They took the human neshama. These are where all the stories of exorcism come from, by the way. Two angles. One is from the whole issue of what is a dibuk and how it's been, how Gedolim used to exorcise them. And the other is from the fact that the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, they took the human being in general, that means the whole population of the world at the time, and they eradicated from the neshama of the human being the desire to worship idols and the ability to connect with prophecy. The two prongs of the same source in the Neshama. It'll take a long time to explain. We'll have to maybe go into it next time. But basically like this. The human Neshama had a point at its inner depth where a person was able to connect with something that's transcendent. Okay, there was a point that goes beyond consciousness, beyond or before, if you like, according to the mystics, before or above, prior in the mystical system, to where the intellect begins, to where consciousness begins. At the root of consciousness is a faculty that can connect with transcendent wisdom. Before you can understand it or make it explicit, then it filters down, as I've explained before. But that root of consciousness, they blocked. They blocked that root of consciousness. Why they did it, we'll have to discuss in detail, because we're discussing prophecy here, and that's exactly where it comes in. But let's just get the facts. They cut that off. The consequence in the world was two things. One is that they did it, the main reason they did it, have to understand carefully, the main reason they did it was to block the drive to idolatry. That means there was a drive in the human neshama to transcend and to connect with a power outside of himself or herself, and it manifested in two ways. Obviously, one was connecting to the wrong source, what's called Avodah Zorah, what we call in English idolatry. That means connecting to powers that are valid powers, but not one, not the source like we're supposed to connect to. And of course, the other side of the same coin has to be prophecy. Do you follow? Both are a utilization of the same channel. Are you with me? Not two separate things. Let's understand this. The human neshama has got one organ. An organ in the body does whatever functions the organ does, they're all vested in that organ. If you take the organ out, you lose all the functions. You can't take out the liver and be left with half the functions of the liver. You follow me? That organ. In the neshama, you have an organ. That faculty, that organ, is the ability to connect with power that's transcendent. Okay? In order to end the desire to connect with things that are transcendent, that are not valid, that we shouldn't be, so they took that organ out of the body, out of the neshama, out of the mind. But when you take that organ out of the mind, so you're left. All the faculties of that organ go. Are you with me? And the positive faculty of that organ is prophecy. It's being able to connect with a shoresh, with a neshama, with the source of the neshama, that on the good side, on the correct side. But you can't have one without the other. Do you follow? The Gemara's got a fantastic description of how it happened. If we get time, I'll tell you about it. But they eradicated it from the neshama. And therefore, no prophecy existed from that time on. The Gemara says clearly that from then on... One thing at a time. Let's just try and lay out the basic facts of the scene. Okay, we'll try and go into more detail next time. The basic facts are like this. Because the world had reached a level where people could no longer withstand the temptation, in a nutshell, like this. The human being had an ability to connect with reality. Today we don't have that ability, okay? Today we don't see reality. Today you look at the world, it looks like a physical place. A person looks like a monkey, there's no difference. A Jew looks like a non-Jew. A Jew looks like a non-Jew. It didn't look the same in those days. Spiritually, you could see totally different roots of the neshama. Right? You could see just as much as you could see a man and a woman were different spiritually, if you're sensitive. You could see that. You could see Jew and non-Jew. Not talking here better or worse, but there were different shoresh of neshamas, different faculties and abilities in the world. As different as male and female. Those things were obvious in the world. Prophecy was around. The mystics say that the world glowed with spiritual power. You follow me? Not just that you heard a prophet say something that you didn't know before. The whole world spoke to you as prophecy. That world had problems. The problem was, let's put it in Musa terms. In Musa terms, they say like this, that since you had an ability to connect with reality, so where was your free choice? How did a person have free choice in that day and age? You walked into the Beis HaMikdash, you saw 10 miracles. You follow? You heard prophets speaking. You yourself saw the glow of the world revealing its inner spiritual power. So what ordeal did you have? Who could ever go wrong? How could you have free choice? You hear the problem? It says that when people were sick in those days, they would go to a prophet. They went to a Navi. There was a special book they had until the days of, I think Chizkiah hid it. A special book called Sefer Refuah. You went along and you looked up in that book, this and this illness, what it was caused by, and the neshama. The prophet would tell you exactly where your problem was, and you eradicated that spirit. You didn't need doctors. It was a completely different world. The whole spiritual world was manifest. So who's going to make a mistake? How could people ever go wrong? So the answer is, the same power that connected you with the source was an incredible drive just to the wrong direction. People had an overwhelming desire to connect to impure sources of power. Valid sources of power, as we tried to explain 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, idolatry is not connecting to nonsense in the world. It's connecting to sources of power that come from the source. But we're not allowed to do that. We have to connect to the source itself. And these are people connecting themselves to the pipes or the channels. But there was such an overwhelming desire that people couldn't control themselves. You follow? The Gemara says it was so powerful that the greatest people, tremendously great people, fell prey. And they were very firm people. They kept mitzvahs and they davened to Hashem. But they also got involved in idolatrous practices because the power and the promise and the ability, what you could do with it, was so powerful and so great, they couldn't withstand it. Why? Because to have free will, Hashem always does that. The more clarity He gives you in one direction, the more power in your personality, the more you're tempted to use that power of the personality in the wrong direction. And that's how you maintain, that's how Hashem maintains everyone's free will. Are you with me? There's no such thing as good or bad in the world. There's only more powerful or less powerful. If it's more powerful, it'll have more power in both directions. As we've said many times before, high voltage electricity can drive very powerful machines, but it can also fry you if you touch it. You follow? Low voltage can only work small things, but it's much safer. It's always like that. There was tremendously high voltage in the world in those days. And therefore, there was a... And it became a stage where it became so dangerous that the Chachamim said to Hashem, take it and take its reward. We don't want it and we don't want its reward. You follow? It's too dangerous for us. We can't risk it anymore. We know that it's in the world to give us incredible reward by resisting it and going in the correct direction, but it's too risky. You follow? It's like a man, if you want, taking a woman into his house other than his wife, who's very, very attractive and has a special bewitching hold over him, in order to resist her all the time to show his love for his wife. That's very nice, but it's very risky. See? So therefore, of that generation, they decided not to play around with this danger, rather eradicate it from the world and say, you won't prove your love that way. So you miss the reward of that great act. So therefore, they eradicated it from the human neshama. But of course, when they eradicated that drive to the negative side, they closed prophecy. They closed prophecy. Because you follow, once that organ is gone, once that openness, that ability, that power, that sensitivity is gone in the negative direction, it has to be gone in the positive. And from that generation on, prophecy was closed. There was another reason also, and this has got to do with the whole discussion about Christianity, which we can't go into now. But the Gemara says, on the day that Ezra died, the founder of Christianity was born. Okay, Ezra was the leader of the Great Assembly, and Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. What they did in the world was they sealed Tanakh on the 9th of Teves. He died, and on that day, exactly, the Ramban goes to great lengths, went to great to prove exactly on which day he was born. He wasn't born in the year that they say, 1991 years ago. He wasn't born then. He was born 200 and something years before that. The Ramban proves it. In fact, he was expelled from Spain for proving it, because he had a debate against the priest. A long story. Anyway, the point is, and why the date has been changed is another story. But the point is that that day, which corresponds exactly to the date of the death of Ezra, which is 200 and something odd years before the beginning of the Common Era, around the time of the Second Temple, when Ezra died, he was born. In Kabbalistic writings, it says that the idea that's connected, Kabbalistic writings, and the Gemara talks a lot about the founder of Christianity, and about his greatness, how great he was before he became what he became. There it says that Ezra's function, what he did was, he led an assembly of great men who closed off the Tanakh and they ended prophecy. That was their last great function. They closed Tanakh, the written Torah, they closed it, they sealed it, from now on nothing could ever be added, and they closed prophecy. The founder of Christianity founded a movement which opened Tanakh and reopened prophecy. You follow? As Ezra died, that force came into the world. That's why they sealed it, that shouldn't happen. And that's why we never accepted it. Never had an attraction for the Jewish people, because we had a clear tradition that it had been sealed and that there was no more prophecy. When they came and claimed that prophecy did exist in the world again and that there was a document, a testament, to be added to the Torah, so it was already sealed from a Jewish point of view, never could be. Actually, the founder of Christianity didn't do any of that. It's important to know that. He didn't do any of that. It was only Paul, who lived 200 years later, Saul of Tarsus, his name was Shaul of Tarsus. He was a Jew who became called Paul in their tradition, was a man who came along and claimed certain prophetic claims and certain that there was a new document or testament that was going to be added. That's what happened. Now, but so we have a very clear difference of opinion, okay? They and Islam also claim that there were prophets that lived after that time. If you want to know, it's an absolute axiom of Torah that there was no prophecy from that time, and there isn't. The Rambam does say that prophecy will be reinstituted when the Mashiach comes or just before then, but we don't have it now. The Gemara says the only place you have prophecy now is in three places in the world: dogs, children, and mad people. That's what the Gemara says. You have a version of prophecy in those three, and the Gemara discusses why. Children are very sensitive to certain things. As they learn to speak, they lose their sensitivity. They're sensitive to very, very powerful mystical things, but as they gain the ability to articulate it, then they lose the sensitivity and they can't tell you about it anymore. Even when they can speak, they're very sensitive to many mystical things that we can't relate to exactly, and as they become more articulate and they grow up more into the world, then they become much, much less sensitive to that. Why that is a long story. People who are not sane, again, you have to know what kind and how, what that means exactly, often they are able to say fantastic things. The trouble is that it's very hard to use because Not everything they say is prophecy, by no means. And therefore, and so after the fact, often one can see these things, but before the fact, it's not useful. And thirdly, it says dogs. The Gemara says that the dogs have a sensitivity to many things. It says, I mean, anybody who knows dogs knows that. The Gemara says dogs, kelev in Hebrew means kalev, like the heart. Do you know that? Kelev spells kalev, like the heart. And the Gemara says that the noise a dog makes is hav hav, which means give give, like the heart that wants. The very, very deep thing what a dog is, exactly. But be that as it may, it says that when the Malach HaMavos is in town, the force of death is in town, the dogs slink at the side of the road. And when he's not in town, they walk in the middle of the road and they can sense exactly when he is in town. When he isn't in town, dogs have that special ability. But that's where we're going to leave it for this evening. We have a clear tradition like this, that the prophecy of the Rambam that he's talking about here doesn't mean you have to believe that there are prophets around now. Definitely not. On the contrary, you have to believe that there aren't prophets around now. But you have to believe that there is prophecy in the world, or there was, and it's documented in Torah, and that Moshe Rabbeinu was a special level of Navi. Yemir Tashem will continue the discussion with you.